Hi, I'm Aria Evans. Welcome to the D Word podcast, where we work to demystify dance. Forms of movement have been practiced since time immemorial. I'm here to reveal insights into why physical expression matters, what it does in our bodies when we watch it, and how it lives within our daily lives. This season, our theme is transformation, transforming relationships, identity, our way of thinking, and social hierarchies through movement. How does dance do this? Let's dive in and find out. I am thrilled to be speaking with Casa Pancho, MBE, member of the Order of the British Empire, founder and artistic director of Ballet Black. Of Trinidadian and British parents, Casa founded Ballet Black in 2001 after graduating from professional dance training. Her initial goal was to provide role models to young, aspiring Black and Asian dancers. Almost 25 years later, the company has grown to a professional ballet company for international dancers of Black and Asian descent, touring internationally to critical acclaim. To date, Casa has commissioned over 40 choreographers to create over 60 new ballets for the company. Hi, Casa. I am so happy to have you here joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Where in the world are we meeting you from today?
I am in London at our studio, and the dancers are all having a day off because we just had a performance, so it's just me here.
Wow, an empty studio. You probably spend a lot of time in those walls doing a lot of things alone.
I do.
So for our listeners, I just wanted to contextualize this conversation because I have a lot of, There's just like really inspiring feelings about this conversation. I don't often talk about myself on this podcast or my identity, but I'm mixed race. My Black descendants and my British descendants and other identities that all form into who I am. And I'm light-skinned. And I found a lot of inspiration reading about Ballet Black. You know, we're in Canada and we don't have a company such as Ballet Black here. And you have like almost 25 years of history. I'm curious, I deeply understand urgency. But how have the conversations internally for the company evolved over the company's rich history?
I think at the beginning of Ballet Black's life, the organization, if you could even call it that back then, because we were one day a week, was me and the dancers. So there were some lines as to what I would discuss with the dancers because of their role. Versus, you know, they weren't management, they weren't concerned with having to raise the funds or anything like that. While they knew why the company existed, I would say there was almost no conversation about anything other than the work for them at hand. And then as the company grew, you know, from then to now, with a board of very diverse people, predominantly Black people and British, you know, I'm able to have really difficult, in-depth discussion about race and what it means to be Black or mixed or not look Black in this country, in ballet, in a way that makes me feel understood, and that I think I wouldn't be able to have that sort of conversation if I had an entirely Caucasian board. And also the beginnings of Ballet Black, I did look to other people outside of our company for advice, but the only people in ballet at that time available to me were Caucasian. So while I could have loads of discussion about ballet, the quality of ballet, the type of choreographer, where we should go, you know, all the ballet side of things, there was never anyone to talk to about the Blackness of it all and why it was important. And there, for me personally, there was no one to talk to about, like you, being mixed race, but not really being obviously mixed. So that's something that's really developed.
Were there artists that you brought together early on where you were able to have those conversations amongst dancers? Like, I'm really curious at that moment 23 years ago when you started to invite people into this company that you were like building the funding for and putting the board together.
The thing about being in a company where everyone is diverse and special in a good way is that you don't, because of that setup, you don't need to talk about what you are, because we are all that or something like that or something adjacent to that. So I think people have always had this idea that we have these kind of militant Black Power chats every day about things. And we're just talking about how to get that pirouette done and how to get into that lift, because all those barriers are removed because we're not saying, why have you got your hair in braids, or can you wear these pink tights, and can you do this role that would probably really upset your ancestors? We're not doing anything like that. So, and we never have. So we don't need to have those conversations. We do occasionally because of external forces that are usually unpleasant. I can't remember the time something great happened that made us talk about race. It's normally always coming from a bad place. And that could be, you know, racist trolls on social media having something to say to us, or a reviewer who, you know, talks about how we're great for a heritage group, whatever the hell that means. And those things are, you know, we do discuss, but we don't spend much time on it. When we have lovely comments, like an email from a parent that says, my daughter saw, you know, a ballerina with an afro for the first time, she couldn't believe it. We talk about those, but again, we don't sit around saying how great that we are doing this. It's just, you know, it's just, we're busy. We've got a lot of stuff to do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's beautiful to hear how those sort of affinity spaces bring people together, and you just get to be yourself. You get to be authentic. It doesn't have to be about an identifier that you all hold. And
exactly.
I want more of those spaces, which it's beautiful that you're doing that work.
Thank you.
One of the things that struck me when we were first talking in our pre-interview was this conversation about microaggressions, and you've talked about trolls.
The last thing, the interaction we had with a really bad racist there was someone threatening to burn down the theater that we were. What I tried to draw the dance world's attention to is that in addition to having to be great at ballet, point work, physical fitness, remembering choreography, learning things that you maybe do or do not like, we also have this other element that no other UK ballet company will ever have to deal with, and that is racist threats and microaggressions, as you just said, and all these other small things that you just are not aware of if you are Caucasian and working in a predominantly Caucasian space. And it's not that that means that no one cares or they wouldn't try and stop it if they could, but it's you just have zero awareness of it. And when I tell people, oh, someone said they were going to come and burn down the building, they are absolutely shocked. But it's unfortunately normal for many of us who are ethnic. But I do sometimes gather it together, like little screenshots, and just post it and say, hey, rest of the dance world, when you keep telling us diversity is great because there's a few dancers in all the companies that are of color, and when you tell us there's no racism, let me just show you the kinds of messages that we receive. And you know, it's also a question, because the last time I did a big haul of, you know, for the first time, nearly every major dance account and some theaters said, well, we stand with Ballet Black in the face of this racism. But I don't really know what does that mean? Yeah. And it's not to disparage those that have said that, but I don't know, that doesn't stop us getting those comments. We don't stop those people buying tickets to those theaters or those other dance companies, or, you know, that's a whole other podcast. Maybe we can come back for part two. What does it mean to say I stand, or there's no room for racism? It's like, there's so much room for racism.
Yeah.
There's so much room. So I'm not sure that
it's
taking up a lot of room. So I think that when people say there is no room for racism in here, it's like, well, I think there is. It's just that you don't like it and we don't like it.
Yeah.
But so
I'm curious, like, I know that the company has revisited its values over many years of existing. Where do you sit now with, like, company values?
I think, you know, the murder of George Floyd really helped put some things in sharp relief for me personally. Until then, although we were fairly outspoken for a British ballet company about inclusion and things like that, it was very difficult to directly challenge a choreographer or an individual or an organization and say, what you're asking of us is not right, and this is why, for fear of them thinking we're saying you're racist.
Yeah.
Which you're generally not, you know, unless you get an outright racial slur, what we're generally saying is what you're doing is coming from a place of no knowledge or little knowledge. And you're asking us to, you know, ask a Chinese dancer to do the Chinese dance in Nutcracker, and it's full of Chinese stereotypes, for example.
Yeah.
And that's not anti-Chinese sentiment on the behalf of the choreographer, probably. It's an inherited legacy of something that someone else a long time ago created and has become sort of sacrosanct in the world of ballet. Mm-hmm. So those people upholding it are not evil. And we're not saying, you're a racist. We're saying, hey, that's not okay, and this is why. But that really means that the person you're saying it to has to be open to listen and not be defensive. And that is the natural reaction to if you're accused or if you believe you're being accused of one of those big things, racism, sexism, homophobia, that kind of thing, those can make you very defensive. So that horrific murder of George Floyd allowed me to jump from the, I won't say anything because I don't know how to say it without upsetting her or upsetting him. And it really helped me realize I don't need to deal with the fragility of people that are perhaps walking in unknowing ignorance about something.
Say it louder.
So I can say it directly. And also where I still felt I couldn't say it, I had more Caucasian allies who could go and say it for me from a Caucasian perspective, the kind of white whisperer, and like go in and say something, and it would be completely non-threatening because it was coming from someone who was the same, you know what I mean? So in that way, I think we are clearer about our values and what is important to us. But essentially, we haven't really changed because we were always for this. We're just a little bit more vocal.
There's something really interesting about the example you gave of the Nutcracker and, you know, in maybe someone's desire to like celebrate someone's culture, they're like, we're going to give you this role. Mm-hmm. But as you said, there's so many stereotypes embedded into these like canons of ballets that have existed across times where, you know, our social awareness was very different. I'm curious, has Ballet Black ever done a classic reimagining, or are you focused more on new work?
No. I mean, we are neighbors with the Royal Ballet and English National Ballet, first of all. You know, we are 20 minutes away from either of them, and they really know how to do a big classic ballet right. So we do not need to be trying to either restage or reinterpret, because most big classic companies, you know, are also reimagining all those old classics over and over. I mean, we've got billions of Swan Lakes and Giselles and things, and that's cool. That works for them. But it felt right from the beginning of Ballet Black, I knew, even though I knew very little at that point, that what we didn't want to do was try and reimagine anything that has been doing to the highest possible level by the Royal Ballet and English National Ballet. It's just London did not need that on its stages. So we know we have things that we consider a Ballet Black classic piece, but we don't have classic works or reimaginations of those classic works.
I find legacy fascinating. And I know it's something that like you're kind of in it. It's hard to reflect sometimes, but now that you're almost at 25 years of history, what kinds of change have you witnessed? And this is a big question. Have you witnessed in the ballet industry?
I mean, there's been a lot of change. You know, sometimes I'm more cynical and I think there's been very little change, but there has been change. I think if I first speak narrowly about Ballet Black, you know, for a long time I would talk about role models and leaders in the dance world changing. And then one or two years ago, several of my dancers, all, I say in quotes, aged out of dancing classical ballet every day, not aged out of, you know, life. They're only like 35 or something really young like that. But, you know, in terms of hips and knees and ankles still being what they were, not so much. And so several of them left and are now doing massive leadership roles. We have a dancer who's a teacher at the Royal Ballet School. Like, what? That's incredible. Yeah. So she's the first year tutor. Her name is Sarah Kundi. So when you arrive at the Royal Ballet Upper School, which is, I imagine, very daunting for a student, the first person that you're going to have interaction with is this very wonderful dancer, very warm, beautiful human being. And she is of Indian heritage. So there's also immediately visible diversity in the faculty. And that is something that 20 years ago would have thought was impossible to conceive at the Royal Ballet School. Another dancer who left, Chira Robinson, who I made the Shoes and Tights with, is now running the Yorkshire Ballet Seminars, which is a massive school in the UK. And it's being run by a Black woman for the first time ever in its history. And Matutu Zeli November, one of our, you know, someone who started as an apprentice dancer and went through the ranks, is now an award-winning choreographer. I mean, I don't even know what country he's in right now. He's making so many ballets. But he's made something for the Royal Ballet, Northern Ballet, Ballet Zurich, us, you know, and I'm sure there are many, many more commissions that I can't even remember. So that was a one big jump that happened in the last couple of years where suddenly several people left and they went into these different but visible roles. And that is exactly what I said Ballet Black should be doing 20 odd years ago. It's just that nobody was old enough or nobody knew enough to go out and do any of those things until they'd had their proper career. And hopefully we've nurtured that along the way and they've all been able to go out and do amazing things. I think another change, of course, as I mentioned just now, is the Shoes and Tights that Chira and I worked with Freed of London to make the two shades of brown point shoes, which then became soft leather shoes and tights as well. So in this country, we were a little bit behind the US who did, I think Gaynor Minden did it first with their point shoe range. And then I know Block do it now. But, you know, to have a British brand do that is something I hope we can point to and say that's a tangible thing that we achieved to make a change. And while I really hate when people today in 2024 say, the great thing is we're starting to have these important conversations, I think we were having these conversations, we, Ballet Black, were having these conversations 20 years ago with whoever we were able to engage with, you know, who would listen to us. And so that's been, you know, Ballet Black has been the little irritant on the behind of the ballet world in the UK. Because as long as we exist, people have to ask, why does Ballet Black need to exist in Britain?
I want to circle back to talking about the Freed shoes and tights that you were able to have created in different tones, skin tones. And like some people listening might be like, Saul, like, what do you mean? but like, what is the process to make them?
It took a long time because for so long, Freed have a, I think it's an Italian satin brand, which is beautiful. Mm. It's pink. It's durable. It's everything that is required in a point shoe worn by ballerinas all over the world.
Yeah.
So to say, okay, let's just make that in a couple of shades of brown is one thing, but to find a durable satin in a realistic human skin tone was very difficult. Plus, Black people come in many shades from your color all the way up to the very darkest hue. And so it was also tricky to, you know, land on a color that would sort of generally be all right for everyone, which of course we haven't really perfected that. But it made sense that because Chira was the sort of kickstarter of the brown shoe, because she just got fed up of pancaking her pink shoes and asked them to make her a custom shoe. And then we said, actually, instead of making just Chira some, why don't we see if we can make a brown shoe for anyone that wants a brown shoe? We started with Chira's very beautiful skin color, which is, you know, a lovely dark brown. but to find something in the right color for Chira took quite a bit of time. We found some lovely things, but they just could not hold up under, you know, a couple of days of wearing, and they would fray and fall apart. We wanted to make sure that the entire shoe was brown, not just the satin, but, you know, the drawstring, the canvas bit that the drawstring sits in, the ribbons, the mesh, anything that you might need to attach to your shoe also had to be the matching color, because the second you have to pancake even a little bit of elastic, for me, it's not worth it anymore. So there was a bit of back and forth about how we would achieve all of that, but we did. And then we found a mid-range kind of bronzy color, which I think you would look very good in. And that was to sort of service those mixed, lighter skin, mixed race Asian dancers. And again, it's a general, it's one shade for that and one darker shade, but it's a, you know, in
it's huge progress. It's a start. And you've used the term pancaking, and I know what that means. But for a listener who's like, what's that? It sounds delicious.
It sounds delicious. And I don't even know why we say pancake instead of painting, but it's where you take something like makeup, foundation, that's your skin color, and then you paint it onto a pink shoe so that it matches your skin color. So when you're wearing the point shoe, from your the tip of your toe in the shoe to your your nose, you are one color. Whatever your line is, you are matching. So you have one continuous line, which makes your legs look longer. It makes your line look nicer. In ballet, we are obsessed with line. We want it to look long and straight and one color. And to have a dark brown leg in a bright pink shoe just really cuts off the leg and the foot, and it doesn't look great.
Submissions are now open for the Dance Currents Fall 2024 print issue. This is an open pitch call. We are a genre-inclusive magazine, and we want to hear from dancers, movers, educators, audience members, and writers of all backgrounds. What are you thinking about? What are you engaging in? What should we highlight? Send us your ideas for features, photo essays, artist profiles, personal columns, dance criticism, and more to submissions at thedancecurrent.com. Please submit by August 26th, and don't forget to check out our summer issue on newsstands next week. One of the things that I loved from our pre-interview was the quote that I have of you saying is, you can still get rotation in your hips with breasts and a big butt. And I was like, it's so refreshing to hear someone say that, because there's such a misconception about what bodies can do and what it means to be able to have a line to, you know, express ourselves in a very like quintessential ballet aesthetic. And when I think about representation, I think about cultural diversity, of course, but I also think about the diversity of the bodies that are on stage. Do you see possibilities of transformation in this area in the ballet industry as well?
You know, I'm seeing change in the UK, definitely. I've seen bosoms, you know, appearing.
I always found it better than butts.
Listen, we like a nice round butt too. But
exactly.
It was always funny to me that if you had big boobs, you couldn't do ballet. It's like, what? Maybe the butt thing, you might say that's getting in the way of something, but the boobs, I really never understood that. I think we are seeing a greater body diversity in British ballet. We've got a long legacy of, you know, eating disorders and this ideal, very slim physique, which is the sort of norm, I suppose. If you ask someone to picture a ballerina, you probably picture a very, very slim woman in a tutu on her tippy toe, spinning around with a tiara. And that's okay.
The tiara,
it's okay. It's fine, but it's just not the only way. And for me, it's just, is your body healthy? So if you're very, very slim naturally because you eat, but this is just the size you are, then great. You know, go ahead. But if you have, you know, a more muscular body or a curvaceous body, then that is good too, as long as you are healthy. We, you know, I'm not saying be overweight in ballet and be, you know, the other end of the spectrum unhealthy. Yeah. But it's always been to me madness. And not, I don't think because I'm mixed race, but it's always been madness that you would have to, everyone would have to be exactly the same.
Yeah. Yeah, I never understood the sort of like corps de ballet either.
No. One challenge with Ballet Black is because we've got a dancer from 4'11" and then all the heights up to about 6'.
Yeah.
So if you want everyone to hit an arabesque at the same time, it's going to be difficult to work that out because you've got crazy long limbs and then little limbs. And so corps de ballet is useful if you want everyone, they're all the same height and size. If you want everyone moving the same way, then that is a benefit. But, you know, we can learn how to all arabesque together at different heights and some boobs thrown in there and we'll all be okay.
What do you think the attachment in the ballet industry is to this sort of like cookie cutter human?
I think it's virginal purity and, you know, women needing rescuing and this sort of female on a pedestal. Not a good pedestal, kind of a she needs to be up there for her own protection pedestal. And it's so prevalent in our sort of traditional ballet stories. As you know, everyone needs, I think everyone needs rescuing. Every now and then the girl might come good and do the rescuing herself, but generally some strapping virile man will come and hopefully she's a virgin so that it's all cool. And I think that's where all of that, it all just goes back somewhere icky. And you know, it's fine for back then, but you know, it's not cool now. So it's, you know, tell those stories if you want, but let's also try and tell some other stories because so many arts organizations are always talking about, we want, you know, a modern audience. We want a younger audience. We need to make sure we're planning for our future and having new, younger people coming in and doing theater or ballet. And, but you can't do that with the same product that you have always used, in my opinion.
It also makes me think about the question that I often have, which is, how could this have been different if it was written, if it was directed, if it was choreographed by a woman? And like having more, you know, female voices in positions of power, I think also challenge those narratives that I just want to say good riddance to. So,
you know, often with ballet, I don't know about Canada and the US, but in the UK, often you'll get into a school at age 11 and then you'll stay there till 16, 17. So you've been with the same, you know, in the same mindset, the same kind of bubble. Then you might graduate into the company that the school feeds into if you're lucky, or you're considered to be lucky if you can do that. Then you stay, you might stay there for your entire career and you've spent maybe 35 years in one way of thinking. So you could have a million female choreographers come out of that and still be telling the same story. Yeah. So I think it's a diversity of experience as well as gender or sex.
As somebody who's mixed race, I often find that I am the bridge between things. I think like by understanding like one part of the sort of like dominant culture and having an understanding of like what it means to be a person of color in the world, there's something that I sort of feel like that's where my place like meets itself. And I don't want to speak for you, but I'm curious, like, where do you feel like your identity sits inside of Ballet Black?
I think my biggest struggle still is my racial identity. Because before George Floyd, everything for me in Ballet Black is pre and post George Floyd. So pre, I think maybe a little bit like what you're saying, I was a non-threatening face, physical, literal face, asking for room in the ballet world. And it was less unnerving, I believe, for some people to say, okay, and let's talk about whatever to me. Post George Floyd, I feel that now everybody wants to show they've got black representation. I don't now meet the requirements of visible representation. So that has always left me I knew in the beginning it was, I was getting a pass to things, using it for good, but still getting a pass that, you know, a Black woman may not have had access to then. And now I think, oh God, I don't, you know, this person's going to be disappointed when they see me pop up on their podcast or whatever, because they're expecting me to look at more obviously mixed race or Trinidadian. So that's, I think, the line that many mixed people just have to walk. And I don't think it's probably not ever going to be as bad as it is for an unambiguously Black person who cannot pretend they're not Black in a moment of danger, you know, whereas you and I could pretend we're almost anything, couldn't we, if we had to save our own life or something really extreme. So I'm mindful of not complaining about it, but it is something that I think about every single day, except really when I'm with the dancers or with the kids at our school. But when I'm dealing with people that aren't part of Ballet Black, I've had someone from a theater sitting down the row from me who like looked to see me when someone said, there's the director. She, oh, she's just a white girl. You know, and that in her mind lessened the impact of having Ballet Black at her venue. And, you know, like, really? Why? Right. I have so many opinions on things like colorism and, and I know what it is and I see it happening and it's wrong and I want to call it out. But sometimes I feel as I am not the color of the person who's really suffering from the colorism, that maybe I shouldn't speak on these. I mean, I do, but maybe I should be more careful about speaking about these topics in a way that seems like I'm doing it without the permission maybe of a Black woman, for example. So I try to remember that I'm speaking on behalf of people that I represent who work for me or with me, or people that historically I've seen be shut out because of things like the shade of their skin.
My last question is, if you are up to sharing, what has been a transformational moment for you in your time as an artistic director? It can be specific to Ballet Black, but it can also just be generally.
Aging has been really good for me being a director. When I was 35, I was still very, very, very worried about what other people thought. And I don't know if that is something that you deal with, but as I have aged, it has been good to let, I still worry about what some people think, but it's been really good to let a lot of that go. And so that has been a gradual transformational thing for me. Unfortunately, as you get older, my eyesight's terrible, my knees are terrible. So there are things that I wish I had known when I was in my 20s and 30s, while I was still really able to do things. You know, youth is wasted on the young. Now I really start to understand that phrase. But I think, as I mentioned earlier, those three or four people leaving Ballet Black and going out and taking those roles has felt transformational, because I always used to talk about Ballet Black as something that hopefully would create people like that. And then the transformation happened. And now I can say it has created people like that. And you can look, there's that one and there's that one and there's that one and that one. So that, you know, for the longest time I talked in hypotheticals, like, you know, if you, these dancers leave Ballet Black and they go out and become choreographers or leaders, then that will start to change the dance industry. And now it's actually happening. And so that is a transformational moment for me, but it's not a moment, it's a kind of wide time period. So it's not like one specific thing is a transformational moment for me. It's a gradual happening.
To hear you talk about the way you've sort of shaped representation offstage by working on stage, there's something really metaphorically delightful about that. Thank you for sharing. You can follow Casa and Ballet Black at www.balletblack.co.uk or on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Ballet Black. And that's our show. The D Word is presented by Dance Made in Canada, a biennial contemporary dance festival featuring Canadian dance artists with unique artistic visions from all cultural backgrounds. The D Word is produced by Mayumi Lashbrook with Taylor Young, editor and composer Damar Powell, sound engineer Chris Dupuis at 1990 Studios, and cover photography by Marlo Porter. And I'm your host, Aria Evans. Thank you to Canadian Heritage, the Canada Council for the Arts, Ontario Arts Council, and Toronto Arts Council for making the D Word possible. Find us wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate and review. Let dance transform you.